Morning, the court's ready to hear argument in Mansouri versus CNA. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May I please the court?
Good morning, Mr. Green.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. Please the court, my name is James Green. I represent the appellant, Darius Mansouri. We are here today seeking reversal of a decision of the Chancery Court and vacation of an arbitration award that was rendered against my client and in favor of the appellee, SCNA Construction. Your Honors, as the court well knows, arbitration is a matter of contract and contract interpretation.
I thought it was also expeditious.
It's supposed to be, Your Honor, and in fact, I'm old enough to remember when it almost was expeditious. We submit today that the arbitrator's award should be vacated because it does not conform to the precise terms of the party's submission agreement. We believe and submit to the court that this result is mandated by the Fagnani case, which was decided by Judge Stiftel way back in 1959, the Malekzadeh case, decided by Vice Chancellor, later Justice Hartnett, and the closest case that we could find in these United States, a case from the Supreme Court of South Dakota, Bold versus Broen. The agreement here we submit was no less precise than the agreement in Fagnani or Vold, both of which mandated that an arbitration award which does not precisely conform to the party's submission agreement must be vacated because it exceeds the powers of the arbitrator, which are defined by the submission agreement.
Did the, as a result of the timing of the submission,
yes, sir.
Did the arbitrator have the authority to say, no, I'm not going to agree to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he have the authority to say, no, I won't agree to that, but I'll do X?
Yes, Your Honor. But the parties cannot communicate directly with the arbitrator after the arbitration. Outside of the arbitration proceeding. And what happened was at the close of the arbitration proceeding, counsel, Mr. Logan and I, addressed the arbitrator and asked if he would address certain questions that we submit. We didn't have those questions. He agreed and asked us to submit the questions to the American Arbitration Association, which is all that we could do because once he leaves the arbitration proceeding, we can't communicate with him. Mr. Logan drafted issues. We had some back and forth. We agreed on the five issues that we wanted specifically addressed. We sent them to the administrator, Mr. Zerwanka, and that letter is at page 121 of the appendix. And at the close of the letter, which was sent and drafted, was drafted mutually. I'm not suggesting any inference of drafting, but sent by Mr. Logan, at the end asked if there are any questions, please let us know. So the arbitrator could have easily said to Mr. Zerwanka or gotten back to us and say, that's not what I agreed to, or I will agree to something else, but not that. So,
well, part of the briefs are almost a semantic debate, you know, which I'm prompted to bring up based on what you said. You asked the arbitrator if he would consider the questions, and consider was the word you used. And then the briefs say that the problem here is the arbitrator did not answer the questions. And then another word that's used is address the questions. At the end of the day, putting all three variations aside, the Court of Chancery said the arbitrator acknowledged the questions, even though he said seven rather than five, and his response to the questions, or his view, we'll call it his view on the questions, is implicit in the award he ultimately made. Is that a fair characterization of where we are?
Well, Your Honor, if you'll let me go back, I think it's two parts. First, we don't agree that the agreement was that he would consider. The letter asks, the letter confirms, and I'm reading from it, we requested Mr. Abriola, who was the arbitrator, address certain questions as part of his findings and decisions. and then goes on to say, we wish to have the arbitrator specifically address these questions as part of his overall findings. And then Mr. Logan went on to say, we want him to have these questions to be considering while we get our briefs to him. So I respectfully disagree with both the Vice Chancellor and Your Honor's question that we agreed that he would consider. So I think it's more than semantics.
It really was a question, not a characterization. But the bottom line is you expected him to list the five questions with five answers.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let me follow up on that, please. Assuming you had gotten what you asked for, what difference would it make?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know because we don't have the answers. But one of the bases for an appeal of an arbitrator's award is manifest disregard of the law. And each one of those questions had a specific answer which would direct us to a certain legal conclusion. So if, for example, one of the questions was this contract governed by 6 Delaware Code Section 3507, which is the Delayed Payment Act, which gives a contractor a right to penalties, interest, attorney's fees. And if he said no and awarded attorney's fees, that would be in manifest disregard for the law.
Okay, well, wait a second. Let me stop you there. You've agreed that the arbitrator could have said, no, I'm just going to give you an answer, numbers, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And if the arbitrator had done that, you would have no basis to appeal based upon a manifest mistake in the law, right?
You're right, Your Honor.
So it appears, doing a little second-guessing here, that the arbitrator didn't want to be put in a pigeonhole where he could have given the wrong answer, at least according to one side, on a legal question, and then open the door for full-blown litigation when the whole idea is this is arbitration, we need a number, what's the number? So he decided not to give you what you wanted. And that gets me back to what difference does it make in the sense that the purpose of the arbitration was to come to a number, correct?
Ultimately, Your Honor.
Okay. And so it appears that perhaps what both parties wanted was to make sure that whatever their legal theories were being followed in reaching that number. But the arbitrator chose not to do that. And I'm having trouble understanding why that means the award should be vacated.
Well, let me try to address that, and let me digress a little bit. In Fagnani, which is as stark as you can get, the arbitrator, when the case was submitted to him originally for decision, could have said, I don't agree that I will give you a decision in 30 days. But he didn't. He accepted the arbitration with the submission agreement, which the parties had agreed the arbitrator would issue a decision within 30 days. Once that submission agreement was accepted by the arbitrator, he was bound. And he couldn't do what the arbitrator did here, is issue an opinion in 37 days and say, I only counted business days. I thought that's what it meant. If he didn't understand what our agreement was, we couldn't communicate with him. He had to communicate with us. And we submit that specifically addressed meant a decision on each issue, and that.
But again, you know, let's assume that the arbitrator got your message and knew exactly what you were looking for, and for whatever reason didn't want to provide it. Wouldn't this whole matter have been finished and unappealable if all he did was send a letter back, dear gentlemen? I will perform the arbitration in terms of coming up with a result based upon what was presented to me. I'm not going to answer your questions. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
I think we would have been stuck. And with due respect, Your Honor, that's not what we have. We
all right, well, let's go with what you have and assume hypothetically there was a way to answer the five questions yes and no, or a way to answer them without an explanation. If he would have answered the five questions with no explanation, what would be your recourse?
I have to analyze each of the questions, Your Honor. It probably would not have a recourse. But the first question has three different parts, for example. So a yes or no, by definition, couldn't have answered that question.
No, I understand. But it leads me into why the Vice Chancellor ruled the way he did. One of the contentions in the complaint was that the plaintiff was entitled to X dollars. And X dollars was awarded. And the Vice Chancellor said, clearly, if that was the contention and that was implicit in it or explicit in one of the questions, the arbitrator's answered that because he's given the precise amount requested. Conversely, there was a counterclaim, for want of a better term, for more money, and zero was awarded. And what the Vice Chancellor said is, if you want to know the answer to that question, it's subsumed within the zero award.
Well, and that's exactly what Appelli argues and essentially what the Vice Chancellor held.
I agree, and this is your opportunity to tell us why that was reversible error.
Because that's not what the parties agreed and the arbitrator consented to, is my most basic question. By way of analogy, if a jury trial judge gives a list of X number of special interrogatories to a jury, which lead maybe inevitably, maybe not inevitably, to the final question is, what do you award? And they don't answer any of those questions, but issue a lump sum award. I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that there is reversible error, because the purpose of those questions is to see if there is an inconsistent verdict or to see if there is a manifest disregard of the evidence or the law. And this is very analogous to that. But we were deprived of our ability to see if there was a manifest disregard of the law, which is an appealable basis of an arbitration award.
You referred to several times the arbitrator having consented to this process. Do the rules, the arbitration rules, require that to be in writing?
I don't have the rule right in front of me, Your Honor. I think the rule R1A says that the parties can amend the rules with the consent of the arbitrator. And Your Honor, I can pull the rule, but I don't have it memorized and I don't have it in front of me. I know it says with the consent of the arbitrator. I don't know if I can't answer that, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
But did the Vice Chancellor seem to rely upon the only indication of consent in the record was the award itself as to what the arbitrator consented to do?
I think that's a fair interpretation of what the Vice Chancellor did.
And why is that wrong?
Well, I would submit it's wrong because that's not what we agreed the arbitrator would do, and it's our contract.
But the issue is, what did the arbitrator consent to do, isn't it?
And that is an issue, Your Honor. And my response is, if he consented to do something different than we set forth in our agreement, he should tell us before it's all over. My other point, with due respect, and my time is almost gone, I saved some for rebuttal, is this. Is our interpretation of what specifically addressed means so unreasonable that the appellee's interpretation is the only reasonable interpretation? And if it is not, in other words, if this is not an unambiguous agreement, then can it be said with certainty that our interpretation is not a reasonable one? And if our interpretation is a reasonable one, then under Continental Oil Company, which versus Poly Petroleum and other precedent, summary judgment is inappropriate.
So let me characterize it a different way. Your argument is that the reasonable interpretation is answer the questions explicitly. And the vice chancellor said it's a reasonable interpretation to answer the questions implicitly.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that really what it comes down to?
I think that's what it boils down to. And the question then is our interpretation, is that implicit, the only reasonable interpretation of what our submission agreement was? And we think it is not.
Do you want to save your remaining time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Logan.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, the Chancery Court's confirmation of the arbitration award was, in fact, a final and definite award on the subject matter of the dispute, and that is the basis under the statute for vacating the award.
And were you surprised that you didn't get specific answers to the questions?
No, Your Honor, I was not. We asked the arbitrator to consider certain issues. Those issues were considered in our brief, and there was no consent at the time that the request was made on February 15th, which was the last day of the hearings on the evidence. At that time, Mr. Green and I did ask Mr. Abiola if he would consider certain issues. He didn't know what those issues were at the time. Mr. Green and I then spent the next week negotiating the language of the letter.
So in your view then, in response to Justice Ridgely's question, the record doesn't indicate that the arbitrator ever agreed to answer the questions. He simply agreed that you could send them in.
He agreed that he would consider them, Your Honor, and he did consider them and consent to a certain type of response because that is contained in his award of May 1st, and I quote, having been given 7 questions dated February 22nd, 2008, to consider in determining the award and the arbitrator having agreed to consider same.
And that's the 5 questions, really.
That is the 5 questions, as the Vice Chancellor determined there is only one February 22nd letter.
Right.
And the arbitrator went on to list the issues that are contained within the letter and has a schedule in the award breaking it down.
So also, your view is he acknowledged that the questions were part of his deliberative process, and although he didn't specifically answer each of the 5 questions, he said, I'm aware of the 5 questions. Here's my award. And what the Vice Chancellor said was his answers to the 5 questions are implicit in his schedule of the award.
That's correct, Your Honor. And beyond that, he was not obligated to do anything other than what he said he would do. He was not obligated to address. He was not obligated to expressly or directly address. And in reference to Justice Ridgely's earlier question, I do know the rule. The AAA rules are very clear that if the parties want a reasoned decision, if they want an explanation of what the arbitrator's thinking is, that must be approved prior to the appointment of the arbitrator. That's done for a policy reason, is because if the arbitrator finds that he is going to have to give a reasoned opinion, findings of fact, and rulings of law, he may choose or she may choose not to accept the appointment.
Can that approval be an oral one, or does it have to be in writing under the rules? Do the rules address how a consent?
It is generally done prior to the administrative hearing that is conducted with the arbitrator, and the case scheduling order will generally be issued at that time, which will say that the arbitrator will give a reasoned award. Mr. Green is right. The parties may agree after to modify the procedural rules. That's Rule 1A. It must be in writing, and it must be with the consent of the arbitrator.
Does the consent have to be in writing?
It doesn't say, Your Honor. But in this case, the consent, to the extent that the arbitrator agreed to respond in any way to the questions contained in the February 22nd letter, are within his award of May 1st, where he said he did consider them. To the extent that he agreed that he would do so, he did, and he addressed them. This is a matter of form, I think, Your Honor, because Mr. Mansouri believes that he was entitled to a greater degree of explanation.
So your position is, based on the rules, if the parties wanted an explanation, they should have made that clear before the arbitrator accepted the case. And they didn't do that. So they went into the proceeding looking for a bottom line number. Then as they got into the proceeding, before the arbitrator ruled, they said to the arbitrator, look at these five questions before you give us the bottom line, is the way the arbitrator looked at it. So what the arbitrator said, I've read your five questions, here's the bottom line. And as far as he was concerned, the submission of the five questions didn't change the predicate for this arbitration not being one that called for a reasoned decision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think I understand the question. But
well, Mr. Green is saying that although we didn't ask for a reasoned decision, we did ask for answers to these five questions. But the arbitrator apparently didn't read it that way. He said, I went into this not having to give a reasoned decision. And although I have agreed to look at these five questions, I still haven't agreed to give a reasoned decision or answers to these five questions, but I've considered them. Here's the bottom line. So one way to look at this is from the arbitrator's point of view. It started as an arbitration without an obligation for a reasoned decision, and the arbitrator ended it that way. And Mr. Green is saying that the submission of the questions somehow modified the original arrangement and called for some reasoning.
Your Honor, at the end of the evidentiary hearing, the letter represented a request under the rules, which is required by the rules. It was a written agreement between two of the three parties that had to agree to it. Mr. Green and I agreed upon the submittal of the request to the arbitrator for his consent. To the extent that he consented is reflected in his May 1st of 2008 award. So the arbitrator did consent to consider the questions. This also raises an issue regarding the case of expectations, Your Honor. I don't think Mr. Mansouri has ever articulated exactly what he expected the arbitrator to do. And they had the opportunity to define specificity. That was the process that Mr. Green and I went through in crafting the letter. It was not my letter. It was a letter that went back and forth several times and was wordsmithed by Mr. Green on behalf of Mr. Mansouri and myself.
Well, did you both want a written explanation in the way of answers to these questions?
Are you asking me what my intent was, Your Honor?
I'm asking, you said that you went back and forth crafting language. I assume that you discussed with each other what you were looking for,
Your Honor,
and reached an agreement as to what you were looking for. What was it that you both expected?
That question was never discussed between Mr. Green and I, as how it was going to come back to us from the arbitrator. That was not the issue. What we were discussing was issues that were important to one or both of us in the case that we wanted to call to the arbitrator's attention so that he would have these considerations in his mind when we did our final briefing. And if you look at the brief
So what you're saying is that the two of you focused a lot on what the five questions would be, but you never discussed with each other, if the arbitrator agrees, then we'll get a written answer to these questions, or if the arbitrator agrees, then he'll just think about these things and somehow they'll be reflected in his dollar award. You never talked about that.
That's correct, Your Honor. My recollection is that issue was never raised. We did not talk about what is it that we're going to see coming back.
Okay.
What did these questions add that was not already or ended up being in your briefs?
They didn't add anything that wasn't in the briefs, Your Honor. The letter to Mr. Abriola preceded the briefing, and our briefing, in a sense, followed the pattern that was laid out in the letter.
Well, isn't at least one inference that if they didn't add anything to the briefs, flow of argument and sequence of argument, that they must have been specifically itemized so they could be specifically answered?
It was not our intention at the time, Your Honor. The letter asks he would consider them. It asks that he would specifically address them. Those words are in there. But it was not my intention at the time to get back from him a reasoned award, because I knew that that had to be accomplished before the arbitrator was appointed, and it would have been terribly unfair to, after having 3 days of evidentiary hearings with an arbitrator believing that the only thing he's obligated to do is give a concise statement of the award, that's a quote from the rules, to then, at the end of 3 days of hearing, to turn to him and say, now we expect a reasoned award.
Is there anything in the record that shows an express consent of the arbitrator to specifically give written answers to these questions?
No.
As an aside, Mr. Logan, the court's always concerned that it not decide an issue that's become moot. Has this award been paid? What's the status of the award?
Your Honor, the award was entered by the Superior Court as a judgment of mechanics lien.
Right, and I couldn't find any stay or reference to a supersedious bond, so what's happened?
It was not stayed, Your Honor. Mr. Mansouri posted a letter of credit in the amount of the principal plus interest. The case was not stayed. It moved forward until on the eve of a sheriff's sale of the structure. Mr. Mansouri posted a letter of credit. The letter of credit was valid if we obtained a judgment from the Chancery Court, an award from the Chancery Court affirming the arbitrator's award.
So
which
you've been satisfied not to proceed any further with execution based on the letter of credit that will make you whole if this appeal is affirmed?
Your Honor, it has made my client whole to the extent that it only required an award by the Chancery Court. It did not say that it had to be a final, unappealable award.
So has the amount been paid?
It has, Your Honor.
And tell me why this appeal is not moot.
Your Honor, there is still a Judge Carpenter ruled that my client has the ability to go back and obtain a certain amount of interest under the Superior Court judgment. But as to the Chancery Court, the judgment has been paid. I would assume that Mr. Green is going to take the position if this court reverses the Vice Chancellor and vacates the award that he's entitled to his money back.
Well, this is awkward procedurally, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the standard that the court must follow in seeking Mr. Green's statement, number one, talking about the standard for vacating the award, was written by Judge Chancellor Chandler just recently in the TD Ameritrade case in 2008. And in that case, I quote Chancellor Chandler saying, when considering whether the arbitrator exceeded its authority, the court must resolve all doubts in favor of the arbitrator. In fact, a court's review of an arbitration award is one of the narrowest standards of judicial review in all of American jurisprudence. If any grounds for the award can be inferred from the facts on the record, the court must presume the arbitrator did not exceed his authority and the award must be upheld. That is the standard that the Vice Chancellor used That is the standard we believe applies to this case, and we believe that it is inappropriate to overturn the Vice Chancellor's decision. As to the cases cited by Mr. Green in talking about the ambiguity, there's a couple issues in that, Your Honor. The Vice Chancellor found that it was plausible for Mr. Mansouri to interpret the word address to mean a explanation. And he found it was also plausible for it to mean to attend to. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Mansouri's interpretation cannot be supported by the rules. The authority of the arbitrator is defined by the rules. In this case, the rules are the American Arbitration Association rules, construction industry arbitration rules. In that instance, the arbitrator, once you pass the question of substantial arbitrability, all of the procedural rules, the scope of the agreement, and the jurisdiction of the arbitrator lie with the arbitrator. The arbitrator, if there was an ambiguity, and we do not believe there was, but if there was an ambiguity, then the arbitrator is tasked and with the power to resolve it and reconcile it, which he did. And it's within his power under the AAA rules to do just that. And he issued an award consistent with that. The award can be inferred from the record that was before him, and he did not exceed his authority in doing so. As to the Continental case that cited by Mr. Green, that was a non-arbitration case. And in that case, the word advance, this court held that the word does not have a fixed meaning. It has broad meanings. That's a different scenario. As to Fagnani, which he cites, and the North Dakota case, the Fagnani case was a case of jurisdiction. The parties did agree in their stipulation that the arbitrator would give an award within 30 days. He did not, and in fact, it was a panel. It was 18 days late. And Judge Stiftel ruled that the panel did not have the power to act after the 30th day. And that's consistent with the AAA rules today. An arbitrator is empowered to act by the rules and is empowered to enter an award. The only other rule that would allow the arbitrator to take any action whatsoever after that period is the rule that allows for a clarification for clerical, mathematical, or technical errors. And the period of time in which a party has the right to seek that clarification is 20 days from the date of the award. Once that 20 days expires, the arbitrator's powers cease because there's no rule that allows him to take any further action. That is why the Fagnani case was overturned. Judge Stiftel determined that it was after the 30-day period, therefore the arbitrators had no power to act, and therefore they had no power to issue an award. As to the case in South Dakota, that was a case where prior to the appointment of the arbitrator, consistent with the rules, the parties agreed that they would have a reasoned award. The arbitrator was appointed and agreed that he would prepare a reasoned award. That was confirmed in writing by the AAA. When the arbitrator failed to provide a reasoned award, the appeal was handed up, and the court determined that he had not met the terms of the agreement because he agreed to give a reasoned award. None of those conditions are present here, Your Honors. Nothing. The only thing that the arbitrator agreed to do is in his award where he said he would consider the questions, and he did, and we believe the award should be affirmed.
One last question, Mr. Logan. And is the judgment in the Superior Court been satisfied?
It has not, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because Judge Carpenter left the door open for my client to go back and receive an amount of interest for a period of time, which I believe it's between the time that the mechanics lien was entered and when the judgment was satisfied.
And where does that stand?
At the present time, it's stayed. It's, nothing's happening on it, Your Honor.
He affirmatively entered a piece of paper that stayed the consideration of interest.
No, Your Honor. The order says that we have the opportunity to come back and request additional interest. We can petition.
And how long do you have to do that?
There's no deadline, Your Honor.
And how long has it been since the principal, for want of a better term, has been paid?
It was shortly after the Vice Chancellor entered his order. It was probably August or September.
And during the pendency of this appeal? Or before the notice of appeal was filed?
It was during the pendency.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Green, let me talk to you a little bit about mootness. For the purpose of my question, I want you to assume this is the law. If a person voluntarily pays a judgment during the pendency of an appeal, it becomes moot. As I understand the recitation of facts from Mr. Logan, you were on the brink of a sheriff's sale. Your client posted a letter of credit to avoid the sheriff's sale, and the letter of credit provided that you could go to the Court of Chancery, and if you didn't prevail in the Court of Chancery, you'd pay the judgment. And here we are with this appeal. If those facts are true, it looks like your client voluntarily paid the judgment at the conclusion of the chancery proceeding and didn't make the payment of the judgment contingent on the outcome of this appeal. So why isn't this moot?
Well, Your Honor, I would say on the verge of a sheriff's sale of a business is not voluntarily, with due respect. But I understand Your Honor's point.
I agree with that. But as I understand it, it was conditioned on the outcome in chancery, not any appeal that might follow.
And we weren't given much choice on the other side of that, Your Honor. But that was a matter of bargaining. Your Honor is absolutely right. I'm not arguing. Those facts are correct. The reason it's not moot is because, as counsel has candidly told Your Honor, they have not satisfied the judgment. They apparently feel they're entitled to more money, and thus it's an open issue. If we're successful, as we think we should be on this, then we don't have to face further proceedings in the Superior Court on execution or the like. So we don't believe it is moot, and we're not asking the court to do something that is a nullity. We wouldn't do that. Is the whole $260,000 at issue? No. My client was essentially forced to pay that to keep his business. But
after the Court of Chancery ruled?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't argue with that. That was the hammer that caused them to take the letter to the bank and pull the money out.
So what's at issue now is roughly $10,000-$11,000 in interest.
I don't know the amount, Your Honor.
Ballpark.
But I don't concede the fact that if the judgment is vacated, as we believe it should be, that we're not entitled to compensation back from the appellee.
But from a mootness point of view, we have the situation where your client paid the judgment. And there may be a dispute about whether he paid all of the interest. But the law is that when the judgment is paid, the case becomes moot. Now, and the Superior Court would be the forum to debate the amount of interest that's owed, but the judgment itself has been paid. Is that correct?
Principle of the judgment, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. You still have about a minute to say whatever you want to say in reply.
To, I'll say two points, Your Honor. Well, three points. First, Mr. Logan was right. Rule R1A does not require the arbitrator to consent in writing, just to consent.
Second, it says express consent, doesn't it?
I quoted the rule in my brief, Your Honor. I think it says the parties may agree in writing with the consent of the arbitrator. If Your Honor has the rule, I quoted it in my brief. I hope I quoted correctly. Point two was, this was not an exercise in futility. We didn't spend a week preparing questions which said expressly address these issues so that the arbitrator could think about issues that we were going to put in our brief. We did it so we would have expressed answers to questions that we asked to specifically address. And the third and final point I'll make is that we're not asking the court to overlook the body of case law which says doubt should be resolved in favor of arbitration. But as this court held in the Parfi Holdings case, the presumption in favor of arbitration does not trump basic contract rules. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.